and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find therein. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In our last episode, we got started on the PE section of the Monster Manual, and today, hopefully, we're going to finish it. That does mean doing 5 monsters in this episode, but my goal is to get them done so that I can then address the Q chapter, which has only 1 monster, in our 50th episode special. That's right, it's episode 49 of Monster Manual. Can you imagine I've been doing this for that long? I mean, I realize they come out twice a week, but still, it's quite a lot. So with 5 monsters, there's no time to lose. Let's get started. We begin with the Pixie. Now, I found myself liking this monster more than I expected to, because in general, I hate mischief monsters, unless they're really like mean-spirited and fun like goblins. But ones that are supposed to be whimsical and funny are usually just irritating. And there is nothing worse than the sight of your dungeon master grinning like a child over the screen at you, while discussing how some allegedly whimsical NPC makes you look like a dum-dum in a world where he has total control over the environment and all the characters, and can therefore do anything in his power, which is limitless, to make you look like the aforesaid dum-dum. It's why Paranoia is such a hard game to run well, actually, even though it's very funny if it's done effectively. But the Pixie here, actually, I think, is not bad at all. First, I love the illustration. It is viscerally horrifying. One of the things that I really like about games are moments, whether that's in the art or the description or whatever, that make characters feel like they really don't want to take damage. Realistically, this Pixie's going to stab you in the foot and you're going to take D4 damage. That's not really all that much. But the image here of the little guy about to drive his tiny little sword into someone's bare foot with all of his tiny pixie strength really lets you visualize how horrible that experience would be. So that's really nice. Secondly, they get a short but interesting rule for the different effects of their arrows, which can either be, you know, arrows that do damage, they can put you to sleep, or they can make you lose your memory. And this kind of made me think of elf arrows or elf shot. Now, in Anglo-Saxon folklore, Anglo-Saxon medicine, elf shot was the name for, like, getting a sudden stabbing pain or, like, a stitch in your side. The idea was that, you know, you had been shot with an invisible arrow because you had a sharp pain. And either naturally occurring kind of pointy stones or Stone Age flint arrowheads were thought to be, because they're very small, were thought to be the arrows that were shot by elves. And this, I think, is where the idea that elves are very good archers comes from. So our modern noble, you know, Tolkien-y elf with his serious expression knocking an arrow into his beautifully crafted bow originally comes, you know, after many layers and interpretations, from the idea of getting a sudden cramp. So that's kind of fun. And certainly the idea that fairies bewitch people and cause them to lose their memories or cause them to go into a kind of trance, you know, that seems very consistent with a lot of folklore. So actually, I think the Pixies are kind of good as long as you give them the appropriate mix of comedy and horror rather than having them be some dreadful, I don't know, maybe I just have a particular aversion to prankster characters. I remember when I was a kid, I hated Mr. Mixisplick. Like, possibly with a passion that is weird, even for a young comic fan. You know, and the Batmite, I can't stand that little guy. And actually, it's mellowed because there have been some good Batmite stories. And, you know, these days I don't think he's so bad, but he's still grating unless done correctly. So maybe I just don't like impish trickster characters. Anyway, I think I like the Pixie in the Monster Manual, even though I typically don't like impish trickster characters. So, well done. Next up, we have the Porcupine, Giant. Like a lot of giant animals, the Porcupine, Giant is only as good as porcupines are. The good news is that porcupines are great. They're a wonderful giant animal threat because we can visualize irritation and pain of getting quilled by a porcupine, and we don't want to have that happen to us, especially not with the 3-foot-long quills of the giant porcupine. Also, porcupines fall into that wonderful category of animals who are both dangerous and adorable. If you have never heard a porcupine, I recommend that you do. Go on YouTube and just search for talking porcupine. There's a wonderful series of videos with Teddy Bear the talking porcupine, because they really do sound like they're talking. They make these kind of Alvin and the Chipmunks noises where they sort of go, and just the rhythms of it sound like speech. Porcupines are adorable and hilarious, and yet you don't want to get quilled by one. Now, I imagine that they're mostly shy and non-confrontational, but you shouldn't, like, get near their young or whatever, which is why the ideal place for giant porcupines is having made their nests in the long-abandoned entrance to this dungeon that you really need to get into. So giant porcupines are effective because porcupines are effective. And the same point applies to our next giant animal monster, the giant Portuguese man-o-war. Now, the giant Portuguese man-o-war is maybe not as good as the giant porcupine for the simple reason that Portuguese man-o-war doesn't really need to be any bigger than it already is to be bad, right? The Portuguese man-o-war is a type of sea animal, or actually it's a group of animals, it's a colony of animals, called a siphonophore. And although people will call it a jellyfish, it is not technically a jellyfish. And they have a sting that can cause painful welk. And if they get all their stingers wrapped around a small person, like a child, even possibly death. Although death from Portuguese man-o-war stings is quite rare. However, their stings are so painful that, say, if a Portuguese man-o-war washes up on a beach, they will often close the beach. Partly because they can still sting even after they're beached, and because the sign of one Portuguese man-o-war washing up is usually an indicator that a bunch of them are going to follow, because they just kind of drift with the currents, and often in relatively large numbers. So the giant Portuguese man-o-war, I guess its stings are deadlier than a real Portuguese man-o-war, but other than that, it's not all that different. But since the Portuguese man-o-war is so well known that everyone has kind of like a vivid sense of how horrible being stung by one would be, I think they work really well. And of course, they're also real freaky looking. Now, I don't know what you call them. I mean, presumably, your game is set in a fantasy world that doesn't have Portugal in it. And not to get into the whole question of linguistics and translations and Portuguese man-o-war is just what we call it, but somehow saying Portuguese man-o-war sounds as weird as saying somebody has their hair in a French braid in a fantasy setting. And yet, if you just give it some other name, if you're just like, oh, here comes the sting floater, or whatever, you lose the specific terror of the Portuguese man-o-war. That's quite an awkward question, really. Still, they're pretty great. They're a good aquatic hazard, and they, you know, trade on the well-knownness of their real-world counterpart. Next up, we got the pseudo-dragon. Now, I am of two minds about the pseudo-dragon, because the pseudo-dragon, as written, I think is actually fine. It's a little dragon-like creature. It's got a poisonous sting in its tail, a bit like a wyvern, rather than a dragon. It's got chameleon-y, you know, color-changing skin, which is kind of neat, and it has magic resistance, and the problem with the pseudo-dragon is also the good thing about it, which is that it confers magic resistance on a character that it's touching. And that is one of the two reasons why pseudo-dragons are so sought after by player characters, right? Because you get the pseudo-dragon, it's, you know, sitting on your shoulder like a parrot, and it gives you magic resistance. That's fantastic. The second reason is that nothing says I am a cool wizard in a fantasy world more than having a little dragon coiled around your shoulders. Or not just a cool wizard in a fantasy world, but then also, like, you can look like Vlad Taltosh. You know, he's got a little dragon. I mean, it's not a dragon, it's a Zhereg. Don't at me. But, you know, same difference. This isn't really a dragon either. It's a pseudo-dragon. Just another reptilian creature that happens to look a bit like a teeny tiny dragon. And what this means is that the pseudo-dragon got overused. Every illustration of a D&D character, it seemed, in that late 80s to 90s era, had a pseudo-dragon perched on their shoulder, to the point where they no longer felt special anymore. I mean, the description says that pseudo-dragons are, quote, rare indeed, close quotes, but you wouldn't know it to look at art of people's D&D characters. Now, obviously, I understand that those characters are rare and special within their campaigns, and there is nothing wrong with people feeling rare and special and having cool stuff that individualizes their characters. I think people should give their characters distinctive features and should stand out against the world. If that's what they want to do, if they don't want to play just some regular schmo, then that's what they should play. People should play what they enjoy. But at this point, being a, you know, a wizardy type or something and having a pseudo-dragon is a little bit like being a tough guy and having a long leather duster. It just doesn't come off as very original. So there needs to be a way to redeem the pseudo-dragon. And I don't really know what that is, because you could reskin it, but it's the skin that people like about it. They like the idea that it's a teeny dragon and it has a sense of the fantastical. So I feel like it's a balancing act. You gotta make sure that there aren't too many pseudo-dragons in your game, and you gotta come up with a way to make it distinctive for your purposes. And that could be as simple as just giving the pseudo-dragon an individual personality that doesn't make it some wizard's cooperative plaything. But even then, you know, is that gonna wind up just devoting a lot of time to one character and their bickering. So, like I say, it's a bit of a balancing act. I think pseudo-dragons can be a lot of fun, and I certainly wouldn't like to try and just blanket exclude them and say, oh no, there are no pseudo-dragons in this game. But they're a case of a monster where their very popularity kind of works against them. And we're going to talk about this a little bit in our upcoming special on the unicorn. And finally, we've got the purple worm. The Purple Worm is a classic, a stone-cold classic. It's got a silly name. I mean, I guess it's a worm. I guess it's purple. Some have suggested that it was originally meant to be a purple worm with a Y, that is to say, another kind of dragon. But here, it's a big, burrowing, underground, toothy, mawed, poison-stinged monster, sort of a bit like a dole from the writings of H.P. Lovecraft, or if you want to be old school, a bowl. And it's got a lot of what makes a classic D&D monster, by which, of course, I'm referring to rules for what happens if it swallows you. Those are typically given to sea creatures, but we get them here as well. A purple worm can swallow you, and you have to cut your way out of its guts in a deadly race against time. I'm all in favor of that. I feel like a purple worm has kind of become a classic D&D monster, partly through its silliness, partly through the alienness of its description, and partly through the fun of fighting a big old wormy thing that's going to gobble you up, and then you have to cut your way out of its guts. I don't really know what I have to say about the purple worm. It's often depicted bursting through the ground. Here, it's shown fighting a bunch of adventurers in kind of an underground cavern complex, which would seem to me to be a very purple wormy kind of thing to do. But the problem, ultimately, is that, I mean, you're not going to find more than one of them. It doesn't have a bunch of clever stuff it can do like a dragon, like fly around and so on. So fight-wise, it is kind of uninteresting in that probably chances are you just go toe-to-toe. It doesn't have any toes, but you know what I mean. I think the challenge and complexity of a purple worm fight ultimately comes not from the worm itself, but from its environment, right? It's the cavern complex that makes a purple worm fight interesting. So don't have your purple worm fight adventurers in, you know, either just a narrow tunnel where they have to just get up in its toothy maw, or the old infinite grid of squares, but really make it fun and interesting, get some different levels in there, give people opportunities to seek cover or positions of advantage, then I think you can have a really memorable purple worm fight. Actually, similarly, a really fun purple worm sneak past could be an interesting thing to do, or you could do the Shoggoth bit where everybody flees down a passageway and it's, you know, squirming along behind them, its bulk filling up the whole tunnel. That's kind of cool. So there are a few options for a purple worm, if you think about it. Okay, that is it for the P section. Our next episode, episode 50, is going to be a listener mailbag extravaganza. I'm going to be answering your emails, your D+ comments, your tweets, and stuff. So if you haven't done one, send them in now. I'm going to be recording at the weekend, so today's your day. You can reach me at the addresses given at the end of this episode, or you can join the Monster Man G+ community and post there. So it's going to be an extra long special episode next time on Monster Man. A show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.